From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, British comic Eddie Izzard. John Cleese called him the funniest stand-up around. Izzard usually performs in eye makeup, red lipstick, and heels. But as the LA Times reported, being a transvestite sets him apart from the crowd, to be sure, but not nearly so much as his intelligent, incisive humor does. Eddie Izzard on comedy and shopping for dresses, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Supreme Court refused today to delay implementation of an Oregon law that allows adult adoptees to obtain their birth records and learn the names of their biological mothers. Some 2,200 adoptees have already applied for their original birth certificates. The law was opposed by a group of birth mothers who argued that the law is an invasion of their privacy and a violation of what they believed was a state guarantee of confidentiality when they gave up their babies for adoption. The Oregon Division of Health said it will issue the first birth certificates tomorrow. United Nations envoy Terje Larsson said today that security measures in South Lebanon have eased tension along the border with Israel. UN experts are trying to verify whether the Israeli withdrawal was complete. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
The UN envoy said that technical teams were expected to finish their work on the Israeli side of the border by tomorrow. They will then consult with the Lebanese government before verifying whether Israel has completed its withdrawal according to UN Resolution 425. Israel hopes that when the UN verifies it has pulled back completely, it will send more peacekeeping troops to the region. The Lebanese prime minister today said that while the Lebanese government will send more policemen to South Lebanon, it will not deploy troops there at this time. Lebanon is expected to be one of the issues at a summit between Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and President Clinton in Germany on Thursday. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Long Island Congressman Rick Lazio has formally won the Republican nomination for the U.S. Senate. He'll face First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton. NPR's Melissa Block reports from Buffalo.
Rick Lazio entered the convention to the theme from Rocky and promptly proclaimed, "I am the underdog." But he added, "He has an advantage his opponent will never have. I can be myself," he said. "I am a New Yorker." Lazio is a latecomer to this race. He jumped in less than 2 weeks ago after the presumed nominee, New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, withdrew to deal with his recently diagnosed prostate cancer. Lazio pledged to work for smaller, smarter government and said he would reject the politics of division. Virtually every official who spoke at the convention had pointed words for the First Lady. One said, "It's time to bid a polite but firm farewell to our out-of-town guest." Rick Lazio now kicks off a 3-day bus tour across the state. As he put it, "We have 160 days to prove who we are." Melissa Block, NPR News, Buffalo.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 228 points, or nearly 2.25%, to close at 10,527. Advancing issues led declines in light trading. The Nasdaq gained 254 points, or 7.9%, its biggest ever one-day percentage gain, to close at 3,459. This is NPR News. Bandleader Tex Beneke died today at his home in Santa Ana, California. He was 86. Beneke, whose given name was Gordon, joined the Glenn Miller Orchestra in 1938 as a singer and saxophone player. He took over the band after Miller's death during World War II. Beneke's friendly southern accent was featured on the Miller Band's hit songs Chattanooga Choo Choo and Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree. Investigators have confirmed that the fatally wounded granddaughter of Los Angeles Police Chief Bernard Parks was not the intended target of a gunman who fired into the car that she was driving. NPR's Aaron Schachter reports from Los Angeles.
Authorities say the gunman was aiming for a man in the car with 20-year-old Lori Gonzalez as the two left a fast food restaurant. The passenger, who has not been identified, ducked as the shooter opened fire on his side of the car. Police are reportedly reviewing surveillance cameras from nearby businesses, including a service station across the street. Meanwhile, the Los Angeles City Council is offering a $25,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the person who killed Gonzalez. Police Chief Bernard Parks has spent the day in seclusion, asking not to be disturbed by the media. Blue ribbons of mourning and support have been placed around police headquarters. And Los Angeles Mayor Richard Reardon, who lost a son in a scuba diving accident, called the police chief to express condolences. Aaron Schachter, NPR News, Los Angeles.
American consumers expressed fresh confidence in the economy in May. The Conference Board said today that its index of consumer confidence rose nearly 7 points to more than 144. The boost came after 3 months of declines. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Eddie Izzard has been called the queen of comedy, the coolest straight man alive in high heels, frosted hair, and drop-dead red lipstick. But as Ron Wertheimer wrote in the New York Times, the first thing you notice after you notice that he's wearing high heels is how smart he is. His interests range from ancient history to society's latest offenses, and his mind leaps from one to another in an extreme of consciousness monologue. Izzard is one of England's stars of stand-up comedy and has become quite popular in the U.S. His life as a transvestite is the subject of some, but just some, of his material. He's on a U.S. tour with his new show, Circle. Last year, he played Lenny Bruce in a British production of Lenny. He's appeared in the films The Velvet Goldmine and Mystery Men, and is in the forthcoming film Shadow of a Vampire. His one-man show, Dressed to Kill, had a successful run in the States in 1998 and was adapted into an HBO special. Here's an excerpt of it.
I was going to join the army when I was a kid. Yeah. Because this is true, because I'm, you know, if you're transvestite, you're not a drag queen. People think drag queen, but no, it's actually male tomboy. That's where it is, because gay men, drag queen, there we go, and male tomboy, they're transvestite. Or male lesbian, because most transvestites fancy women. This is just a little bit of information for you, because you... because no one knows, no one f***ing knows at all. So it's much more running, jumping, climbing trees, putting on makeup when you're up there type thing, you know? And I used to keep all my makeup in a squirrel hole up the tree. And the squirrel kept all the makeup on one side and he kept his nuts on the other side. And sometimes I get up the tree, that squirrel would be covered in makeup. La, 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 la. Oh, you're here. Oh, sorry. What? Wrong color for me, what?
I spoke with Eddie Izzard after a recent performance in Philadelphia of his show Circle. You describe yourself as a transvestite, but last night you looked very butch. You were wearing, aside from the high heel boots.
And the trousers, which were actually women's trousers, even though I don't call them women's trousers, but they were sort of women. I think they zip up the other way around, but...
Oh, I know. Like, the only difference between men's and women's trousers, for the most part, is, like, which side the button is on of the
exactly,
thigh.
Exactly, exactly.
Yes.
So it is a nonsense anyway.
Right.
But I didn't actually go into explain that I'm not really a transvestite, because I think that no one is a transvestite, because I don't think it means anything anymore. It's a very second millennium idea, I believe. I think now we're in the third millennium. I'm a vestite, if anything. I'm a clothes wearer. Women have total clothing rights. Men should have total clothing rights. It's there for men to take up if they want, especially in Western society. It's more difficult than an Islamic situation. I don't know quite what happens in an Islamic country, but I will just wear whatever I want. But my sexuality is sort of male lesbian, male tomboy. That's what it's been since I was four. But I will wear whatever I want, and like women can. And that's great that women can, and just men just got to play catch-up on this.
And do you feel like sometimes you have butch moods and sometimes you have more femme moods?
Yes, I think so. I think I do feel somewhere between a cross between a butch and femme lesbian in a male body. But I'm not bothered about being in the male body so much anymore, because I can wear what I want when I want. Because people get fixated about what you're wearing, but it isn't. It's more internal than that. But the only way to... seemingly to access the internal is to externalize it or to because people in the street will react to you how you're looking. It does seem to be a very external thing, being what people consider to be transvestite. And there's, of course, women transvestites, but no one calls women transvestites transvestites. And probably women who are transvestites would not consider themselves transvestites. But they do exist, and I have had letters from one, and I've had people come to me, I think I might be a transvestite, you know. But they wouldn't. Who would want to use that term? Because it's such a negative, it's got such negative baggage on it.
When you're on stage performing, do you feel like considerably different if you're wearing, you know, a dress versus if you're wearing, you know, slacks?
No. Because the show I did before, the last show on, I was wearing a skirt on. So I'm just going to keep changing it every night. But not really. You do, all you do is you move differently in heels. The heels I was wearing last night are slightly more difficult to move in than the heels I'm wearing today. And it's practicality against, I quite like those heels. So I don't feel hugely different. I don't approach the comedy differently. And that's something that I sort of wanted to do, which is, that, you know, my personality is the same. I'm just trying to land this alternative sexuality in a place that's fits into society more than transvestite has been considered before. Because transvestites just way out on the fringe still. And gay and lesbian people are much more part of society. And it's, you know, they've moved a long way since the 50s, whereas transvestite hasn't been.
Here in the States, though, it seems a lot of gay groups are adding, like, and transgendered people to their titles.
Yes, that is brilliant. I mean, because the Gay and Lesbian March in London was, I was thinking, you know, great, can we get transgender? I didn't know what the word would be. And then they said it became the Gay, Lesbian, and Transgender March. So I thought, oh, that's good. That seems to be moving forward. It's just, I think we've got to get our image together because it's quite difficult. There is the frumpy transvestite image where everyone thinks, so what, you're going to be big guys with bad wigs on and sitting around having tea. And it's got to move forward from that. So, but it's good.
Did you think of yourself as a frumpy transvestite?
Oh, yeah. If you come out as being transvestite, quite often it does seem to be blokes who are quite blokey looking, you know, because there's a big part of boy going on as well as this sort of girl going on. You do tend to do boy activities and you'll play sports and football and even join the army and stuff like this. But so therefore, they can be quite big guys. And then it's kind of wigs that don't fit and clothes that don't work. Because you don't get the chance. The trouble with being transvestite, if you're in the closet, is you don't get the chance to go out wearing clothes. And then people say, what do you think? Oh, that looks good on you. Oh, I should think you should change this. The whole thing that younger girls and young women will do, which is trying on things. And their friends will say, that doesn't work with you. Oh, that really works. You know, just the thing of just trying things out in society in a normal way. And if you're in the closet, you're just trying on things and you're just wearing whatever that you can get from a catalog or something. And so it becomes, you're just sort of wearing stuff that doesn't really suit you. And you have to be right out to be able to get into a sort of look that works. And it has to be that sort of tomboy area because quite often, if you are TV, you're kind of in the, have a blokey look to you.
Before you came out as a transvestite and felt comfortable, like wearing whatever you wanted to on stage or, you know, with friends, did you just dress at home? I mean, you know,
yes, it's
behind
all,
closed doors.
It's all behind closed doors, and with occasionally going out. I decided at 23, I thought, is it 23? Maybe 21 or 23, that I decided I had to sort of come out. I actually said it out loud, I think. I thought I should come out and tell everyone this, and then I thought, no, this is a ridiculous idea. And once I'd said it out loud, it became like an idea that wouldn't go away from me, and I thought, no, I should just be open with this. And also, I'm quite designed for a challenge. My actual genetic thing, it's something, I don't know, from my dad or whatever, that we're designed for a bit of a fight, the Izzards. It's just a family thing that I needed. You know, I didn't know it was going to be being TV, but seeing as it came along and I am TV, and I thought, well, I'm going to be out about this, and if people give me hassle, I'm not going to back down. I'm just going to keep going forward. So it sort of sits well with me. And hopefully, if younger generations coming up who are TV will think, hey, well, I'm going to be out and open about this, because we need to get people out and find out how many people are TV.
So your attitude was basically, I'm going to wear a dress and heels and fight you.
Yeah, well, I mean, I did have a fight in Cambridge. Some guys picked on me and they went for me and I went for them, but there were five of them. But then I took the main guy to court and won, so.
Really?
Yeah.
You took him to court? What
yeah.
was the trial like?
The trial was interesting because it was very low key. It was just a magistrate's court. It was common assault. And he tried to, his main argument, he had a very cool lawyer, actually. Rocky Horror Picture Show. You know Riff Raff in that? You know the guy who's the long, straggly hair?
Right, yeah.
His lawyer looked like that with a sort of short cut. He just looked amazing. I was quite intrigued by his lawyer. But anyway, he was pushing for the idea that I had started the fight. And I would talk about this in my stand-up, just the idea that a bloke would put on makeup and a skirt or something and go out looking for a fight is just nonsense. But anyway, that was what they tried to push, that I'd thrown the first punch, which wasn't true. So he got a £200 fine. So I got £100 of that, so I went and just blew it all on.
When you started wearing whatever you wanted to on stage, and sometimes that would be, you know, a dress or a skirt, did you feel like audiences responded to you differently or had different expectations of you?
The first 5 minutes, that's the key thing. I think first 5 minutes, everyone's going, people who had no expectations were going, oh, what's going on here? And then after 5 minutes, it was just, okay, is the comedy any good? So it was there's a 5 minute sort of startup period where people think, oh, so what's going to happen here? Because they do think, I think, that the comedy is all going to be sexuality driven. The sexuality should not be a part of it, I don't think. I mean, I could bring it in, like, if I could play piano or speak German, I could bring that in. But it shouldn't be, like, the whole thrust of it, because that's not where my comedy comes from.
What was the turning point where you decided, okay, I'm coming out about this?
The turning point was saying it, really. That it was. I was up in Sheffield, and I told an ex-girlfriend of mine whose brother was gay. And so that was my first time I was telling anyone. So that was a big release. And then it was somewhere around that time, I just remember saying, looking out a window and thinking, I'm going to tell everyone this. And then I knew it was a line that I just wouldn't do. But the line just stayed there. I'd said it in words. So it just kept floating around my head for about 2 years. And I thought, I've got to do this. So it just became the obvious thing that I had to do. Just to be open, be honest about it, and be truthful, and let's get some more information about it, because it does seem like a fringe of society thing. And in fact, I feel it's there's a whole logic to it, and it needs to be discovered and explained. And I still don't know all the ins and outs of it. I need to sort of place it somewhere in society.
Did people look at you differently when you started cross-dressing in public as opposed to just in private? I mean,
no. Well, they never really knew when I was doing it in private, because it was just me.
Well, that's the thing. They didn't know, and then I imagine you got a lot of stairs.
Oh, yeah, you get a huge amount of stairs, and you have to really sort of...
stare back?
Well, no, it's not stare back. You can't really... You don't have enough confidence of that. You feel hypersensitive. You feel that everyone's looking at you, but then...
And they are.
No, they're not, actually. They're not, actually. Some people are. Some people are not... I went out and I started studying how people look at people just wearing kind of more blokey clothes, and I just sort of realized that some people seem to be looking at you, some people are looking past you, some people are just walking in that direction. You will feel that everyone is looking at you when you feel that if you went out with a duck on your head, you'd feel that everyone was looking at you, whereas they might just be, you know, thinking about, you know, that sort of glazed eye, thinking of things to themselves. There's a lot of different ways that people look at people, and so I had to study that and just get calm about it. And also you need to just sort of say, well, this is my space and I'm going to do what I want. You do need courage to do it. So it's you have to be kind of ballsy about it.
My guest is British comic Eddie Izzard. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Eddie Izzard is my guest. He's a British comic who is currently on tour in the United States. He's also been in several films, including Mystery Men and The Velvet Goldmine. What were your early performing ambitions?
When I was seven, I wanted to be an actor. I decided... My mother died when I was six, and I remember doing a play before she died, and I wasn't that bothered about it. I played a raven, and I got one laugh, and I wasn't meant to get it, but I said a line back to front, and... got a big laugh, and I thought, oh, that's quite interesting. But I remember at the end of that not thinking, right, I've got to do more raven parts. Probably because I didn't want to be a raven. But then she died, and then I remember seeing a play, and I thought, God, this guy's getting applause, and someone was being really funny on stage, and I thought, I'd really like to do this. And I've come to the conclusion that it's something to do with my mother dying. She was very affectionate. She disappeared, and I was looking for an affection machine, a surrogate affection machine, I've called it, with the audience there. So if I did good stuff on stage, the audience would say, oh, that's good, and it would be like some sort of affection deal with the audience. And it's quite a healthy way of dealing with it. I think other people have done this. So that's where it sort of came in at 7, and I wanted to be just an actor. And I like comedy, but I didn't realize you could specialize in comedy. So I just auditioned for all the school roles and got zero, got
really?
Nothing. Yes, because I was terrible, or because everyone who was auditioning me had no, could not see what I could do. But I'm not sure, because I was sort of annoyed, really annoyed at the time, because I thought, give me something, just give me a part. I want to be in all these plays, and I was trying really kind of cunning ways of trying to root myself into things, and still getting no decent parts. So it wasn't until I was about 15, 16 that I got a decent role. And I was pushing from really 7, 8. I was really doing odd things to get into shows. But in the end, it gave me a stamina. It gave me a real-life stamina. So when I went, I came out, left school, and I went into the real world, it again took me 10 years to get off the ground. But I had the stamina of already having 10 years at school where I was just trying to get any parts. So it was quite realistic, my training at school.
How did you start comedy?
Comedy came when I loved comedy, watching it on television. The whole family had a good sense of humor, so we'd all sit around watching stuff on telly. And I discovered Python, really. And I suddenly realized these people do this for a living. They just do the comedy stuff. And I really liked the comedy. I didn't realize you could just do sketches. I knew about Peter Sellers before that. Peter Sellers was probably the first person that got me into it. And I thought, comic actor. I thought, yeah, I could drive in this comic actor area. I got into comedy because I realized that Monty Python existed and did all these stuff on television. So that was 69 when they started happening in Britain. So I was 7. So, yeah, I don't think I picked up until later.
Now, I think your early comedy performances were as a street performer. In England, and from what I've read, it sounds like in your early act, you rode a unicycle, you did sword fighting in the street, worked with trick handcuffs. Were you planning on joining a circus?
No, it's the problem with the street is you have to do physical situation comedy. Being really analytical, which I gained from coming out as being a transvestite and having to self-analyze myself, I gained this gift of intensive analysis. So I analyzed the street, because I went down, I thought, I'll get the street in 2 weeks and then I'll be doing shows, people can give me some money, I can earn a bit of money this way. But it took me a year, and people will not respond to spoken word. If you go out and do stand-up, unless you had a huge amplifier behind you, you cannot do sketches. You can't do sketches or spoken word, because there's not enough glue out there. There's not enough... the audience won't stick around for that. They need to see something physical, situation in front of you. So that's why juggling and magic and stuff works. Visual things. Visual things really kill out on the street. But the spoken word, it just gets lost and people can't quite hear, and then there's no sense of atmosphere, and there's too much other noise going on of wind and rain and cars and people and other people laughing. And so you couldn't do stand-up out there. You had to do stuff that was sword fighting or these really weird tricks and fake knife throwing used to do, or getting on a big unicycle and getting out of a pair of handcuffs. That ended up as my big stupid show. I wasn't really into the show, but I could talk a lot of inane, strange comedy in between it, and I could lace it in between the show. And they would stay because I was on a unicycle and I might die, basically.
Exactly.
It was like
right.
A car crash thing. They were thinking, this is a car crash waiting to happen. Maybe he'll die. You know, even on a tough day when it's raining and snowing, I'd still sort of hang around in case I died. I thought that was my essential glue. It's a sort of, will he die? Oh, he hasn't died. All right, let's give him 5p. So that was the show I ended up with. But what I really liked on the street, what I really learned was how to start a show. And then starting a show, you have to build it up from nothing. And so there's about 20 minutes which it takes to build up enough of an audience so that you can actually start. Because if you start with too small an audience, you never actually build further from that. It's quite complicated.
So how would you start the audience?
Well, it was quite often it'd be just getting... Well, I'd put down tea cozies. I had these tea cozies that looked like animals. They were a duck tea cozy and a... you call them tea cozies that you put over...
The little quilted thing you put over a teapot to keep it warm.
Yeah, that's it. And there was a duck and a penguin and a hippopotamus, and I just bought these. And I used to put them on the ground very slowly. And I discovered this thing. Well, I didn't discover. I noticed other people doing it on the street, that if you put something very slowly down with a lot of focus on the street, people will watch you doing it. It will draw their attention because they think, well, what are you doing? If you just have a lot of focus and you put it just very gently down the street. So I was doing this, and I'd take about 20 minutes to put these out. And people would just sort of form around thinking, well, he's going to do something with these tea cozies. And then I'd never do anything with them. So I just managed to build up an audience that way. Or I'd talk to people, and I'd sort of... In the end, I was actually just standing on the street and just spieling to people. I could just go on and on and on and build up scenarios. And people would just walk across in front of me, sort of ignoring the show while I was trying to build a show. And I'd say, oh, this is Janine and this is Sarah. They're dressed up at the moment as they're playing characters. I've employed them to do this. As you can see them walking through, they'll ignore me. They'll ignore me because they're very good. They're always in their characters. They never sort of come out of character. So I'd impose this scenario. These are just two women walking across, and I would impose the idea that they were actors portraying two women who happened to be walking across. And then I'd say they would change. In 5 minutes, they'll come back as different characters. Then I'd pick two other people and say, that's them. That's them now. And everyone knew it was rubbish, but it was quite neat because it sort of worked. And I could do this imposing scenarios thing and sort of get a certain atmosphere going as if I was controlling things, as if I... You have to use what's going on and look as if you're the master of ceremonies in this show, but in fact it was just stuff happening around you.
Eddie Izzard, he'll be back in the second half of the show. He's currently on an American tour with his latest show, Circle. He opens in Seattle tonight and then goes to San Francisco, Los Angeles, and New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Alcatel, providing integrated voice and data networks for the Internet, enterprises, and carriers worldwide. At www.alcatel.com. And from Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, putting on makeup for the first time, we continue our conversation with comic Eddie Izzard. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with British comic Eddie Izzard. He's famous for his performances and for the lipstick, eye makeup, and heels he wears. Izzard is a transvestite, something he talks about, but not a lot, in his performances. He's currently on a U.S. tour with his new show, Circle. He opens in Seattle tonight. Here's another excerpt of his earlier show, Dressed to Kill, in which he's talking about early American history.
The Founding Fathers in 16... They set off from Plymouth and landed in Plymouth. How lucky is that, eh? Get there and go. This is Plymouth. This is Plymouth. We set off from Plymouth. Come. We've gone round in a circle, lads. Back on the boats. Come on. This is Plymouth, too. My God, there's two Plymouths. Back on the boats. Eventually, they get to America and go, ah, this is where the... This is the place that God has brought us to. We can raise a family here. We can practice our religion. There's nobody here. Excuse me. There's nobody here. No human soul on this land. Who are these people over there with a big... What's that feathers stuff on their heads doing? Could you... What? No, we weren't expecting you. Our God has brought us here, and... No, we don't want any of your food, thank you very much. Just put some clothes on, for God's sake. Have you no shame? Meanwhile, that winter... Excuse me, do you have any food? I love all this stuff on your head. It's a fantastic idea, really. Very adaptable, aren't they, the immigrants? Yes, yes. Lovely. Got your own religion? Fantastic. We got one too. Thanks. Hello. Lovely. Yes, we were trying to grow bananas. Didn't really work, but thanks. Thanks for the food, anyway. Yes, there's more of us coming, but we all keep our promises.
Now, you were born in Yemen while your father was working there for British Petroleum.
Yeah.
Any memories of that period?
Unfortunately, zero. I was one when I left, and we're going to go back. But my dad was there 8 years. My brother's there about 3 years, and we got a there's a film of it. There's a standard 8 film that my dad took and edited together, and it's and that is my memory essentially, which is I know what it looks like on this sort of flickering,
right,
standard 8 color movie, and my mum's there and I'm a baby and my brother's there on his own, and then suddenly I turn up and then he's poking me in the eye, and so I know what it's like there. But we will go back, but I guess. I know it's like Luna, really. It's like flat sand and then huge mountains coming out of flat sand. So I feel like a lunar landscape.
Your mother died when you were 6, and after that you were sent to boarding school.
Yeah.
Whenever I see a movie that's set in a British boarding school, there's always an element of sadism in it, where the older boys pick on the younger boys, and it seems like it was a pretty uncomfortable place to be for a lot of people. How was it for you?
It's the classic one of the Tom Brown school days, which has this thing called fagging, which is, basically people work as servants for the elder boys, and they can beat the hell out of you. And that's, I think the amount of bullying or whatever that went on was typical for any school. It didn't, you know, there was some that went on, but it wasn't overtly in that sort of stuff you've seen in films. The first school I went to, I really didn't like. I just didn't like. Well, it was. I was 6, so I just. It wasn't a great place to go, and it was a bit like being on a desert island. But the second and the third, the second school I went to had a more healthy place. Which first one was in Wales, South Wales, and the second one was in the south of England, and that one had a much more. The headmaster there was a decent guy, and. It was a generally positive place. There was a certain amount of bullying that went on, but, you know, that was just what happens in schools. And then by the time I got to the third school, which is kind of probably harder to deal with, I was already, like, you know, like a rock in emotionally. Like, you know, I wouldn't cry. No one was going to sort of give me a hard time because I was going to give them a hard time first. So I was already built to resist any problems that would come up.
When you were in boarding school, were you able to use humor in self-defense?
Yeah, it was absolutely. It was to get popular at school and get popular with girls and just to get popular, basically, to get more popular. Well, because I used to, when I was up to 13, I used to play football, and I lived for football, and that was my kind of, that was which you call soccer. But that was the thing I loved, and this is why I'm a male tomboy. This is football and makeup. I was in the first team, and, you know, and it was school matches, and that's what I lived for. Then I went to the next school. They didn't play football. So, and I wasn't very good at the other sports, so I just, I lost a center of where I was going. And even though I liked acting and stuff, I hadn't had any parts up to this point. So I started pushing slightly more on this acting stuff. And then I started developing that I could do this comedy in the classroom and be witty and do those thrown lines, those lines that you throw at the teacher when they're in between a comment. You can just drop a line in that really works and cracks the class up. And that was working well. And then there were no girls at school until the sixth form, so I was about 17. And then a few girls turn up in this. It was bizarre. So you have one girl for 20 boys. So it just didn't. I didn't talk to any girls for a long time because I wasn't playing sports. I wasn't head of the school. I wasn't. I was just some guy wandering around with greasy hair and acne, basically. But the comedy got me out of that comedy because I found that I could use that in the class, and it just. It was a social tool, really.
How old were you when you started thinking, I'd like to try on a dress and some lipstick?
4.
That's really young.
I think you'll find with most transvestites, I know gay and lesbian people, I haven't checked with everyone, but I hear different stories in different people, but I feel it's genetic or chromosomal built in. So I was 4 and it struck me. And it stayed consistent ever since then. So I just think it's inbuilt, and it's not, because people say, your mother died, and they're 4, and I think, no, I just don't see that. It might be something to do with it, and I want to keep an open mind on it, but I do think it's just been inbuilt and some sort of genetic code that I have got. It's a gift, in fact. It's kind of weird, but it is a gift. If you come through it all, it just makes you see the world in a different way.
So when was the first time you actually acted on the impulse to wear makeup or dresses?
It got a bit weird because my mum died, so I and there was no sisters in the family, so I had no access to anything until there was bits of there was occasional stuff at school, but really I got to college, and then when I got to college I was doing theatre shows, and there's a whole wardrobe department there. So I thought, hey, I'm running this show. I can go in this wardrobe department and just say, oh, let's borrow this.
Did anyone ever walk in on you before you were out and you had to, make up an explanation about why you were wearing a dress?
No, that didn't happen. I once got some kids sort of chasing after me saying, why are you wearing a dress? Why are you wearing makeup? And they were trying to. I was trying to go home, and they were trying to follow me. So I thought, I can't go home now because they'll know where I live. So I thought, I sort of wandering off in a different direction, and they kept chasing after me until I thought, right, I'm going to talk to them. So I stopped and said, look, you want to know? You want to talk to me? Come and talk to me. And then they just ran off. So that taught me something. I thought, everyone's just scared of their own shadow. But that's that kind of bullying thing, because they were pushing, and so I turned around and said, okay, what do you want to talk about? And then they ran. And I find this with little, small, young children, girls, boys. If I'm wearing makeup, they'll come to me and say, you're a girl. This thing which, for a boy, when you're at school, is supposed to be the big thing you can't be.
Oh, there's the biggest insult.
Yes, and that's the one that's undefendable. You can't, and you have to say, no, I'm not. And they go, yes, you are. You're a girl. And when I'm wearing makeup now, and little kids will come to me, you're a girl. And I go, yeah. And then they stop, and I think, hang on. That's supposed to work. And they said, no, you're a girl. I go, yeah, I am. And then you can just see the confusion on their faces. And it's almost like they're getting into a group huddle and saying, look, surely we should say he's a girl. He should say no. And then we've got him. But if he's saying yes, that's denying the whole, we've got no argument to go to. And they could just see that they can't deal with it. They have to wander off shaking their heads.
Do you ever go through a period of wondering, well, maybe I'm not just a transvestite, maybe I really want to be a transsexual, maybe I really want to be a woman, and maybe I want a sex change
Oh, yeah, no, transvestite, transsexual are adjoining rooms with an adjoining door. Because people have said, I've said it defined before, that they are very different. But in my opinion, transvestite, transsexual is just a little bit further down the line. I could change sex, but then when I just think I would. I think I would sort of want to change back in a way, because I appreciate more being the male side of me by being able to access sort of a more feminine side of me. So seeing as I'm now in a position where I can wear what I want, I think this is fine. It's not I don't think anything ever gets to perfect. I don't know what perfect is, but I'm quite happy in this state. And if I did change sex, I'd just think, well, I'd be thinking, well, I should change back, and I should change sex again, and change back. So I'm okay.
Did you ever have to tell a girlfriend who didn't know that you were transvestite that you were, and then she had to react to the fact that you see yourself as a male lesbian, which might have been confusing to her?
Yes, I think it is slightly more difficult in relationships, but the main, because women think, well, how does that reflect on me? What do you think of me, or what will other people think that of me if I'm going out with someone who's transvestite? And it gets a little bit confusing for a woman in that area. But generally, it's, I mean, a lot, I thought most women would just say, well, that's it, I don't want to talk to you. But in fact, a lot of women are very positive and supportive and curious about it, being out about it, being TV. So, it's a lot different to what I thought it would be like. A lot better, a lot more positive. Way more positive. If I had my life over again, I said I would be TV. Like, it seemed like it would be so much simpler, seeing as I fancy women, just to be straight, you know. But it's actually taught me so much, and it's so much of a quest thing. You've learned so much. You gain so much in confidence and understanding how human nature works by being TV and having to come out, or being gay or being lesbian, the whole coming out thing, that I just found it really positive.
My guest is British comic Eddie Izzard. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is British comic and actor Eddie Izzard. He's currently on tour in the States with his latest show, Circle. Now, how's your movie career coming?
Well, it's sort of, I'm still got my foot on the pedal of the motorbike, and I'm going, and it's sort of, I think the engine started, but it's still not moving along hugely fast, because I'm getting small parts, and I don't think I've done great stuff yet. I mean, like, there's a scene I saw in one of the films I've done, and I thought, that's decent, that's good, because I don't want to do, I'm trying to do straight roles in the films, straight dramatic roles, as opposed to comedy, surreal roles. I am trying to, it's slightly in a different area, and I don't want to bring all this sort of stand-up thing to it. I don't want to think, I should do a comedy line here or something. Like, quite often you see it in Hollywood films where someone who's got known for doing stand-up goes into a film and seems to go into a stand-up routine at some point. And I think I don't want to do that. So I'm just gradually getting my, you know, getting my feet, learning how the camera works and everything. And I've done about 7 films, small roles. And one or two of them, you know, one or two scenes, I go, yeah, I like that scene, I like that scene. If I took that scene and that scene, put them into a show reel, then I could say, yes, look, I'm coming along. I haven't done anything stunning yet.
You have a small part in a forthcoming vampire movie. What's it called?
Well, it's actually, the producer said, make sure it's not a vampire movie. So it's not really a vampire movie. It's a story about the making of Nosferatu, which was a movie about a vampire. But so it's not a sort of Hammer House of Horror type thing. It's John Malkovich and Willem Dafoe star in it. And John Malkovich plays Murnau, who's the German director of the film Nosferatu. And Willem Dafoe plays Max Schreck, who played the vampire in that film. So we're all the German actors and technicians and cameramen who are making this film. And they go on location, which is very unusual in the 20s. Like, everyone just films in studios. And he decides to go off and do it on location. So it's, and there's a very nice twist in it, and so hopefully it'll be an interesting film. I don't do anything terribly interesting in it. I seem to ask a lot for food. My character just keeps saying, "Is there any food here? I'm very hungry. You know, I would like to." What is this? This is blood. What is blood doing here? I need food. I just go on about food for hours. So I find that quite funny. But, yeah, it's... I want to see it when it comes out. I need to see it on the big screen because I've only seen bits of it on the video so far.
Earlier, you had said something to the effect that there's a certain logic to being a transvestite. Would you elaborate on that?
Well, I think the logic that I'm talking about is if you look at men and women as these two separate camps, and then you say there's gay, lesbian, and transvestite, transgender people, you think, well, surely there should be in these two camps of men and women. And there's a big crowbar in between, a big gulf, big huge river in between, and that's how it should be. But I think you need to look at sexuality differently, and then you can find logic to the alternative sexualities. Because if you think that girls and boys are pretty damn similar when they're growing up until they hit puberty, like if you dress a girl as a boy, a boy as a girl, they would look pretty similar. And then it hits puberty, and then there's a spinning out, which I think Mother Nature says, right, okay, you guys are going to look differently because we need some of that procreation stuff to happen. And so I'm going to make you look quite different. So you think, oh, I want something of the other. And then later on in life, it goes back to old men and old women looking pretty similar again. And I think that sexuality is one long straight line, not this big two camps thing, but one long straight line. And everyone is somewhere along the line. And I was trying to compare, like, once I hit the idea of male lesbian, it made a lot more sense. Certain things in, because there's gay man iconography, lesbian woman iconography, certain things or interests that will match up for a lot of lesbian women, I think, a lot of gay men, a lot of transvestite men and transvestite women, who's sort of totally invisible in society. And they will link up. And I'm trying to look at, like, just talking around to friends and people I meet, what are the things that sort of link up in each group and how they, like gay men and straight women, there's a number of things will link up there. And there's some women I said, well, you're really a gay man in a woman's body. And they think, well, yeah, I suppose I am. And that's kind of curious. And you think, well, is that they are gay men in women's body or gay men or women in man's body? It's interesting the number of link-ups and the way that psychologically different groups will work the same. So there must be a pattern there. I see a pattern there that can explain all of sexuality without it seeming so confusing, because TV seems so way out in the fringe, so I can't deal with this. But I feel I've come to a conclusion that I can explain most of the facets of it and knit it into society, because I'm just a person who does a creative job and whatever, but I happen to be TV. So I'm trying to create that space and trying to see the pattern of how all the sexualities link together, I think, is an important thing to do.
My guest is British comic Eddie Izzard. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is British comic and actor Eddie Izzard. He's currently on tour in the States with his latest show, Circle. When you describe yourself as a male lesbian,
yeah,
what does that mean to you?
For me, it's trying to say that initially when I said I fancied women, journalists, even today, I've just read one that someone said, he is a heterosexual transvestite. Now, I don't say that because it seems like you're trying to hide. People say, well, you're hiding from being gay, because people don't understand that transvestites, 90%, I do believe, fancy women. So male lesbian makes more sense to it. It takes away from the idea of you trying to hide in being heterosexual. But also, you do seem to, there seem to be femme and butch lesbian going on in male TVs. It just seems to link up that way. That's how it seemed to be a way of explaining it to me. And as you explain it, it sort of confuses initially. You say it, and then people go, right, what does that mean? But male tomboy. Tomboy was an easier one, because everyone can know, okay, girls can be tomboys. They can wear makeup, but then they want to climb trees and they want to play football. And just imagine a male, one of those. So I'm a bloke who likes to climb trees and play football and also put on makeup and dress up and go out. So that's what I was trying. I need to get these little buzz lines, they're sound bites essentially, just so I can explain without taking hours over it, because it is complex. It is complex, and you have to take a lot of existing prejudices and theories and say, right, those are just dead theories, right, forget about them. And I'm being kind of strong with this in the sense that I might not be right, but I think I'm probably more right than a lot of people, because I'm my own guinea pig. I can test it out on my own self as long as I'm honest.
Let me ask you a shopping question. There's a lot of, like, hip boutiques or something, and I'll walk into, and people just kind of look at me funny because I maybe, like, don't look quite, like, hip enough to qualify to shop there. Or maybe it's because I'm, like, short and they know nothing in their store is going to fit me. But, you know, I do get some strange looks. Like, I'm not really a member of the club, you know, that really hip clothes club, and they know it. What kind of looks do you get when you go shopping?
I have trained myself not to take in looks.
Mm-hmm.
I trained myself to think Elizabeth Taylor. And I remember hearing about, I thought that would come in handy. This is Elizabeth Taylor, but, you know, about in the 50s or 60s. I read about her turning up. Richard Burton was filming, and she turned up in Italy. He was filming in Italy. So she turns up in Italy, gets the chief of police to take her out to the set. So with screaming motorbikes and sirens and everything, she turns up and gets out in some sort of coat out of a Rolls Royce and out of police cars. And just thought, well, yeah, that's a way to do an entrance. And I found, like, trying on clothes in shops, If I go up and say, I'm a bloke, I'm going to try on this skirt. If I say, can I try on this skirt? And I think I found that most people in shops go, well, I don't think that's possible at all. We'd have to kill you first. Surely that's illegal in several states and hangable. Can we hang on for that? But I found that if I say, I'm trying this on in there, I'm going now, then they go, ah, fine, right, okay. Because I'm just trying to own a cubicle. I just want to buy their clothes. They want to sell their clothes. So it's a confidence thing, and I found that if I asked, then I would get rejected. But if I said I am doing it, they go, fine, you do it. And that's an interesting attitude, and I have to be just really upfront and very knowledgeable. Like, you quite often get these people go, can I help you? Very quickly, especially if men go up to makeup counters. And I have to say, yes, I want these lipsticks are no good. I don't like those. Those are kind of mushy, right? And I have to be very knowledgeable in my area of makeup just so that they pull back a bit and don't get in my face. Well, these are very nice. Who is it for? So, it's for me, and I want this, that. Don't want that. That's rubbish. That's way overpriced. And you may as well burn that lot because it's useless. And I kind of get kind of aggressive in that way so that they just back out of my face.
Would this work for me, do you think?
Yeah, I think you have to assume you have to think Elizabeth Taylor. You have to think, or a person that's going to work for you. You have to just come in and be very disdainful. If you feel you're getting disdain towards you, double the disdain back. And if they say, can I help you? You say, I'm sure you can't.
You see, this is how being a theater person can really come in handy.
Yes, well, exactly.
Because I'm not good at that kind of stuff. I mean, I'm not good at, like, thinking Elizabeth Taylor. I can't really pull that off.
I think you can if you practice. Elizabeth Taylor might not work for you, but it worked for me. It's just, you've got to think someone who you think, right, I'm going to think that person. And try to stay, just be, think, okay, people are going to give me hassle, so I'm not going to assume it, because you don't want to attack if someone's actually trying to be helpful,
right,
or whatever.
Right, right.
But you just want to be up there and in that kind of high eyebrow kind of, yes, I don't know if your shop is really worthy of me. That's what you really need to think of. Listen to Walkman is a very good way of doing it. I found going into very... those shops when I first started earning a bit of money, and I sort of go in there and there's one person in there and it's very quiet and everything. You pull out socks and they're sort of, you know, 100 quid,
right.
100 pounds, and you go, gee, I can't even breathe on these socks. And so I found that I would just put on a Walkman and I'd be very kind of like, as if I'm a designer, because Because that's what look you come into. You come into like you're a designer. You just say, I do this thing. This is my job. So just be very quick and pull out the stuff and throw it back. And this is rubbish. And then just walk out. And if you adopt that attitude, they'll have to bow down to it. Because all they're doing is adopting an attitude of snottiness towards anyone who comes in. So you just got to crank your ego up, get on the raised eyebrow thing, and just and a Walkman can really work because you can just listen to music and they could be saying, can I help you? And you're just, they can come right up to your face and you just ignore them. Because when people say, can I help you? I never look at them now. They say, can I help you? Because then you go, probably not. I don't know. You know, you just get into a lost thing. So when they say, can I help you? I just go, no, I don't think you can. And I just make sure that it's that one of the last things that's on my mind is talking to them, because I just it takes me into a low status thing. And they must know what they're doing there.
Well, I appreciate all the advice.
It does work. You just have to practice it. If at first it doesn't work, just keep thinking, okay. Keep in the zone.
Well, Eddie Izzard, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks very much.
Eddie Izzard is currently on a U.S. tour with his latest show, Circle. He opens tonight in Seattle, then takes the show to San Francisco, Los Angeles, and New York. Here's another clip from his earlier show, Dressed to Kill. He's talking about going through puberty and how just as he was becoming attracted to girls and wanting to look his best, his body started sprouting hairs and pimples that made him feel grotesque.
You know. And then I had to chat girls up, and I'd never had the ability. You know, I'd only tagged them before. Now I had to use verbal skills. Susan, you don't have the ability at 13 to be able to say, Susan, I saw you in the classroom. The sun came from behind the clouds, and a shaft of sunlight caught your hair, golden framing your face. Your eyes burned blue fire into my soul. I immediately read the words of Dostoevsky and Karl Marx. And in the words of Albert Schweitzer, I fancy you. But no. No, at 13, you're just going, hello, Sue. I saw you in the room. I've got legs, you know. Have you? Oh, yeah. There they are. Do you like bread? Look, I got a French stick. Yeah, French loaf. Boom. Bye. I love you. And you always shouted, I love you.
Fresh Air's senior producer today was Roberta Chirac. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Monique Nazareth and Patty Leswing. Research assistance from Helen Wong. Anne Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Elektra Entertainment, producer of the release from Billy Bragg and Wilco, Mermaid Avenue Volume 2, featuring unreleased Woody Guthrie lyrics set to new music. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, comic Jon Stewart, host of The Daily Show, Comedy Central's nightly news program. This summer, the show will broadcast from the Republican and Democratic conventions. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.